And good morning, everyone. Once again, welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. You know, that magic time after sunset, before sunrise, when different things take on a different perspective. When the things you kind of look at in daytime and say, oh, give me a break. At night, at this time of night, I don't know, it's almost like we're living two separate or maybe overlapping or parallel realities, and I'm going to mix the realities right now by directing everyone to othersideofmidnight.com, our homepage. You should have that marked somewhere so you instantly can go there. And then upper right-hand corner, radio with pictures, that takes you to tonight's show page. And at the top, you will see something which Rich has kindly labeled Richard's items. Item number one. I know there are folks out there who cringe every time I bring up the word politics, and that's part of the problem, because the reason we've lost control of where we're going is because a lot of people, a lot of very good people, have just said, like Robin in years past, a pox on all their houses, because it's all rigged, it's all fixed, it's all an inside game, and that's why stranger things have happened. You know, she at the moment is supporting Donald Trump. Now, am I happy with that? No. Do I understand it? Yes, because it's looking like the gateway, the doorway into realizing that politics is really important. Otherwise, nothing gets done in society and people don't get along and things basically ultimately collapse. Rome. Is because people disinvolve. People sign off. People go away. People, you know, basically take a time out. And that's when the bad guys win. So item number one tonight is the story about Hillary's campaign manager, John Podesta, who is the only person in this campaign season so far in the mainstream holding an incredibly critical position. He's Hillary Clinton's campaign manager for President of the United States. You cannot get more mainstream than that. And every time John gets an opportunity, what is he talking about? UFOs, ETs, what's out there, the bigger reality against all the things on this planet will ultimately someday be measured, engaged, and in many cases, as I could make the case if we had another show tonight, which we're not going to do tonight, will actually determine whether or not we survive on this planet, this one tiny, you know, blue dot, as Carl used to say. So I find it fascinating that John Podesta is repeatedly in tweets, in press releases, and I think a couple, 3 days ago, in an interview with George Knapp, who, of course, is based in Las Vegas during the Las Vegas, Nevada primary, during the caucus, not the primary, John came out and again said on camera, all the things that we know are kind of hovering in the background, including, you know, Hillary and her comments to the editorial board in Conway, New Hampshire, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the crossover point. This show, as you know, I'm trying to model as the bridge between what people think of as normal and what other folks think of as paranormal, like paranormal is a real thing. If it exists, if somebody reports it, it isn't para, it happens, it's their experience, so it has to be explained, and ultimately an explanation for things going on in the universe is a unified explanation. We don't have different laws for different folks. So that's the touch point, that's the magical crossing of the real and what a lot of people still think of as the, quote, unreal. That crossover point will become more important as this year and this campaign season goes on. And again, as I was kind of warning the gang before we went on the air, there are people listening tonight, people in interesting places. The thing about this show, as we've demonstrated repeatedly, is that people can listen from anywhere in the world. Ergo, Michelle in Japan, and last night, Michael in Hong Kong. And of course, I've had guests from England and guests from other places on the planet. And we will have many, many more. We are a global society. We're a global civilization. The national boundaries in terms of these conversations, which affect the entire human family, no national boundaries. But as they used to say about the 800-pound gorilla, you have to watch very carefully who is at leadership, who is at the top in the next 4 years in this nation, in this country, because what this nation does, where we throw our weight, where we throw our perspective, where we put our energy, will determine a lot of things, including the future of the extraterrestrial question. And that, of course, brings me to link number two. As you know, for many, many months now, we've been following the rather remarkable discovery by the Kepler telescope in orbit, launched by NASA back in, I think, 2003, of its discovery of a remarkable star about 1,500 light years away in the direction of the Earth's orbit around the galaxy. It's kind of out in front of us, 1,500 light years literally in front of the Earth and solar system, moving around the galactic center every roughly 26,000 years. Well, 1,500 light years in front of us in that journey, about the same distance from the galactic center, is a star known as KIC 8462852. That star, the Kepler mystery star, was discovered in 2003, and then sequentially, in some months later, and some months after that, to be undergoing remarkable eclipses or transits by something that's coming between us and the star. And this is a very healthy star. It's a young star. It's a much brighter star than the sun. It's a bit more massive. It will live quite a bit shorter, just a few billion years instead of about 10. And there seems to be something of a mega, mega, mega nature orbiting this star. In fact, one of the experts we had on the night we discussed this on a major show, we're going to do more, he estimated that the star-covering object, the object that's orbiting, that is somehow causing these eclipses, down to 20% of the light, that star is orbited by something that may be as wide as the star, which would be about a million miles. Except it can't be another star, because if it was, we would see the gravitational effects, we would see the light curves, we would see all kinds of unusual properties. Instead, we have a very normal, absolutely average, run-of-the-mill F-star orbited by something which is absolutely wondrously mysterious. And, of course, we're all waiting for the next beginnings of a transit, which will now be caught not just by official telescopic observations from orbit, can't be seen by Kepler, because Kepler is now looking in a totally different direction due to certain technological problems. It will never be able to look at the star again unless it magically recovers those two reaction wheels. But ground-based observatories, professional observatories, and much more important, just kind of like the political campaign, the grassroots, the thousands of amateurs with really cool equipment, you know, Celestrons and Questars and Meads and all the other people who make big telescopes and CCD cameras and computerized equipment. I mean, any really decent amateur now is equipped as well as or better than most professional observatories within the last 50 years. And so what we've done is to democratize the ability of just ordinary folks connected by the web, the internet, to look at Kepler, to look at KIC 8462852, and ring the alarm bell, ding, 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 when the next eclipse begins. And at that point, as you heard my guest describe on that show, a whole bunch of very intriguing and important professional observations will bring us a lot closer within days, once we start to see the eclipse, can do spectral work on it and all that, whether we're dealing with a cloud of dust and a hi-ho silver or something much more interesting. Which takes me to link number two in the reverse. Because after the Kepler star was discussed and made, you know, major news for weeks and weeks, there were a team of scientists, a couple of guys, I'm going to actually get their names up here in a moment, who kind of looked at this through the other end of the telescope, and they realized that potentially our own searches for extraterrestrial life in the galaxy, the SETI searches, the radio searches at Arecibo, the other efforts by various observatories to look for lasers coming from stars as blinking lights or modulated light beams, and, of course, good old radio, that they may, in fact, be looking in the wrong way in terms of finding the proverbial needle in the haystack. What do I mean by that? Well, the reason we know tonight that something really bizarre is going on at the Kepler star is because we're in line with the orbit of whatever is causing the eclipse. So these two guys, Rene Heller, who's at the Max Planck Institute for Solar System Research, and I believe a co-author whose name escapes me at the moment, Ralph Pudritz, who is a professor of physics and astronomy at McMaster University in Canada, they have reversed the equation. They've said, okay, what would happen if aliens were to adopt the same search strategy for finding if they're alone as the Kepler folks did? And so what they have proposed is that we forget the whole sky, you know, 360 steradians or whatever the technical term is, the entire celestial sphere, and instead concentrate in a band which basically is a distant eclipse zone of the Earth orbiting the Sun, the so-called Earth transit zone. If you can imagine the Earth orbiting the Sun once a year, and if you imagine it shrunken down to the size of, let's say, a wedding ring or a hula hoop, you know, suspended in space, the Earth's orbit represents the band of the wedding ring, and the Sun would be in the center. And, of course, the Sun is sending light in all directions, so it would cast a shadow when it, you know, the Earth orbiting the Sun would cast a shadow over 1 year, a line traced on the celestial sphere repeating every 365 and a quarter days. And if there's a star in that zone, you know, light years away, tens of light years away, 1,000 light years away, if they were out there looking toward the Sun, they would see, just like Kepler did with KIC 8462852, they would see the Earth and the other planets, because they're all basically almost in the same plane, periodically cross the disk of the Sun, the tiny, 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 tiny disk, all those, you know, thousands of light years away, and they would mark a transit, an eclipse, and the Sun's light from that perspective would dim and then would come back up to normal as the eclipse ended, as the Earth moved off the Sun from their perspective. And of course, none of this would be visible unless they have really super huge, amazing space telescopes miles across. So they're doing the same thing that we are doing, which is inferring a lot of this from the geometry of the light curves and the projection of eclipse zones and all that. The difference, of course, is that with sufficient technology, they would know that the Earth was potentially habitable, because their super telescopes, given that they're aliens and given that they're more advanced, which is the assumption, they'd be able to note that we have an atmosphere. Furthermore, they would be able to actually determine spectroscopically the composition of the atmosphere, and they would note the nitrogen and the CO2 and the methane now and then. And then they would note the oxygen. And they would note that oxygen is so bizarre as a free molecule, because it wants to glom onto anything given half a chance. They would then realize that there was a probability that the free oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere detected during that eclipse, even if the Earth was thousands of light years away from the ETs looking, they would know that there's a potential that the oxygen is caused by biology, by life. And if they have a long history of monitoring the Earth this way, they would actually have seen changes in the chemistry of the atmosphere, and they would be able to model those changes, comparing it to the evolution of life on Earth from simple one-celled organisms billions of years ago to complex life forms, i.e. intelligence, creating industrial smog, creating, you know, climate-changing gases, all those things that cause heat trapping. They'd be able to model all that based only on looking at the Earth's atmosphere as it evolves over time. Of course, a very, very long period of time. But then we don't know the lifetime of an ET civilization. That was one of the unknowns in the famous Drake equation. So if they had any long-term observations, they would likely conclude that just maybe this place had some kind of intelligence on it. And then they would, of course, be listening. And then, of course, they might actually be trying to communicate, try to send images and messages and, you know, heads up and, hey, we're here and that kind of thing. So that's what the Kepler star discovery has initiated, a whole new search strategy. And instead of millions of stars across the entire sky to search through, the proverbial classic impossible needle in a haystack situation, they've now been able to reduce the search to, they say, about 100,000 stars are in that zone, that tiny, tiny, tiny narrow zone, a vanishingly narrow band around the sky where the Earth would eclipse the Sun, and where those folks out there would know by looking at us that something interesting was going on here. Well, with that as prologue, what we're going to talk about tonight is what our solar system would have looked like just maybe a few million years ago, because according to the work that you're going to hear tonight from a bunch of very smart guys who've independently been looking at this and doing this for many years, this solar system once was stunningly different, was potentially as exotic and as attention-getting as KIC 8462852, because wherever we look now, on whatever planetary surface or little objects orbiting the Sun, even out to the distant, frozen, and astonishing surface of Pluto and its five moons, and I use that in quotes because some of them don't appear to be moons, they appear to be ancient, very big spacecraft, i.e., was the Type II civilization that lived here part of a galactic community? So, in fact, there are folks out there who have looked now at this system from afar and said, isn't it a shame what happened over on Sol 3? With that as prelude, my guests tonight are Keith Laney, who's a space imaging, processing, and anomaly specialist from Charlotte, North Carolina. You got a primary coming up, Keith. Got to get out and vote. He's a husband, father, grandfather, artist, copper master, amateur space scientist, and avid promoter and supporter of space exploration, which, of course, is why he's on the show tonight, among other things. And then we have Bob Harrison, who is all the way over in the sunny, sunny isle, that wonderful green isle of England. Bob is an investor. He was an investor. Now he's retired because he basically made a lot of really good investments. So now he can devote most of his time to space, to looking into the solar system. And he's been specializing in Mars and looking at Cydonia, and he's written a series of astonishing papers and articles on Cydonia Quest. By the way, all the guys tonight, their websites are listed by their names on othersideofmidnight.com, Radio with Pictures. Then we come to Andrew Curry, our new friend, Andrew Curry, who's an artistic genius, I would say, because he can now take these images, these 2D images of what NASA's giving us, and he's created the most remarkable three-dimensional reconstructions, and the fun is going to be someday to have on the right-hand side Andrew's work, his artistic recreations, and on the left-hand side, the actual perspective views, close-up of these astonishing arcologies that we've all been tracking. And finally, least but not last, or last but not least, if I get my tongue out of the way, Will Farrer, who is talking to us tonight from Maryland. He has a very interesting career in technology, particularly information technology, where he is now director of a national healthcare company, technology director, as well as, you know, maintaining space anomaly channels, called What's Up in the Sky 37, and the website called whatsupinthesky.com. He's got a very good eye for spotting anomalies, and he also knows how to analyze the anomalies. And on that note, gentlemen, welcome to the other side of midnight, and where do we begin?
Will, go ahead.
Well, good morning, Richard. How are you doing, Will, out there? If we have the big people out there listening to us today, we're gonna put on a nice show for you. We pulled out a couple of the good ones. You guys want to start on the moon, since it's the closest to us? And that will bring us up to Richard's page. How about that? You guys want to start there?
Okay, so where do we want us to go?
Okay, let's go ahead and go to the other side of midnight.com. And then I want you to go ahead and hit on the top right, Radio Pictures. Mm-hmm. It's going to bring us down to our show, the imaging panel. And we'll start with number one under the panel items. Well, actually, one through four.
Oh, my God.
This is a very
What the heck is this?
Now, this has a little backstory to it. My friend Maurice Van Veen, he runs one of the Lunar Anomalies groups out on Facebook. He sent me this picture, the Apollo image number 3 down there. And when you can click on the images, we'll do that in a second here. He sent me this originally, and I'd put out a video about it saying, gosh, that looks like a straight wall and something weird next to it. You really can't make it out. But
It looks like a straight wall with a bend.
Yeah, exactly. If you're looking at first, we got number 3, and then what I did was I figured out the coordinates from the Apollo image.
Okay.
NASA's done a really good job with some of these Apollo images of having where the spacecraft was at the time, where it was taking the picture of. You could find the craters around it, and it took a little bit of time for me to do. But number 1 and 2, I was able to find in the LROC.
This was the forwarded images from your friend 1 and 2.
Yeah, 3 was the one from my friend, the Apollo image, okay. And I was able to go out and find number 1 and 2 on my own.
Okay.
And what we're looking at is about the size of the two, the top piece and the wall piece.
Okay, hang on. Let's give it a little background. LROC observation M118769870L. Sorry about all the numbers. The LROC stands for Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter Camera, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Beautiful images come back from there.
Stunning.
And if you click on number 1, I think this is the best one that we have of it so far. There are another couple images out there, but they were more deeper in shadow like the other. And we just got a great sun, like the where the sun was, the azimuth, everything just came down perfect, and we could actually see this. And the dimensions of it, because if you look at number 1 and 2 back-to-back, you can start to see where the sun's pointing one way and you've got the sun pointing the other way on the other. The stark difference between the two.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, this gives us three-dimensional data, and you can almost synthesize artistically, hint, hint, what the real shape of these things are, because we got these two different sun angles. You're right. Number 1 is better resolution. Number 2 is a little degraded. Maybe the spacecraft was at a higher altitude when they took that one. But what do you think we're looking at?
I think we're looking at scale-wise, we're looking at something that's modern-day stadium. Like, if we went down to Washington, D.C. or outside D.C. where the Redskins play, you're looking at about the size of a huge football stadium.
400 or 500 feet.
Yeah, at least, and that's for the wall and the piece up there next to it. So you've got two really interesting pieces, and it's in the middle of nowhere. If you actually pull up,
that was my next question. Where is this stuff?
This is if you were to see that we didn't put my link on the actual page here to my website, but if you pull up the actual image itself, it's in the let me find out what region it's in there for you. It is in the I had it written down here on the
looks like a mare, which is one of those dark blotchy seas that are not seas on the moon, the dark areas.
Yeah, it's in a dark area, and it's really surrounded by nothing. There's a couple craters about the same size, but they're definitely craters. There's nothing that sticks up, especially in the real long, they're 26 miles or 26 kilometers by 2 kilometers strips that come back from the LROC.
Right.
when you're looking at the images. There is nothing around these. This is what really brought my attention to it when I was looking. I was like, there's nothing around here that looks anything like it. I've had people try and tell me, that's maybe just slag from something smashing into it. And when you really look at the dimensions here, it just blew my mind. I was like, this has to have been the remnants of something. It almost looks like something, the wall there is protecting whatever's behind it. If you happen to look at the wall.
You know what it looks like to me, Will? That's why I asked you where this is. If you continue to pin that down, and if you can send the link over to M, and she'll send it over to Keith and Rich, and we'll get this posted, because we've got to show people the original NASA data so they're totally convinced we're not making this stuff up. I think if it's in a mare, which is what I kind of, you know, in this very tiny, tiny two shots, if it's in a mare, that means the mare is made of lava, which flooded up from inside the moon and submerged and destroyed buildings, and this is what's left of some, maybe a mega complex of buildings, and these were the two highest ones left that didn't melt, that didn't collapse, that are still there in fragments amidst nothing, as you said before.
I just went ahead and I sent the link over through Skype, so hopefully they can post that out on the website. That's a really great idea there. I never even thought about that. To me, because it looks like there's not. It doesn't have. It's got dust on it. It just looks so out of anomalous and out of place to me. It's been one of my favorites with the moon, and we put this out on my page about a year ago, and we've had great fanfare for this one. She just sent that over. See. So people can go out there and take a look at this themselves.
If we refresh the page, let me see. Does the page, is it up on the page yet? Not yet, but it will be. So be patient. So continue, please.
Yes, that link will be there for you, so you can actually tell them, put them right under the pictures.
That'd be great. Yes, right under the pictures.
Right under the pictures.
Under 1 and 2.
Bingo.
Okay.
And then you go out there and see, and this is actually a good page to send people to anyway, because as Keith has time and time told me, these are the images to look through. There's hundreds of thousands of images that you can browse in very high-resolution data.
This is from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Yeah, and you can even request them to – I noticed a spot on their website earlier, request imaging done from them. I guess that means it's still out there and
it's very much alive.
Yeah,
right? You know,
it's out there working.
Yep.
Let me say something. That craft returns about 5 gigabytes of photos every day. It's automatically processed and goes into the archives. Dr. Robinson himself says that those pictures are mostly unseen by people
because they don't have the manpower.
Right, he's got like a staff of 30, and they cannot comb through every one of those huge images.
What an opportunity for the audience of The Other Side of Midnight. We could help NASA and show them interesting things on their own data. Hint, hint.
Let's see if we go back now to your page. I think it should be there now.
Okay, well, I'll refresh. Oh, there it is. Wonderful. And perfect timing, because we're at the bottom of the hour. It's amazing how time
goes. We're already there.
We're already there, yes. Okay. Say what, hold it all, guys. This is going to be so interestingly cool. My guests this morning are the usual guys that talk to us all the time on this subject, except tonight we're going to talk about things other than Pluto and the rest of the solar system, starting in our own backyard. And oh, you ain't seen nothing yet. My guests this morning, Keith Laney, Andrew Curry, Will Farrer, and Bob Harrison, way over there on the sunny Isle of England. You're on the other side of midnight, one step into forever. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. This is our friend Wright, a tune called Sidonia. We'll be right back. And we are back on the other side of midnight for our friend Patrick in Georgia, who's waiting to hear my weather forecast because he's going to get the weather we're having today, tomorrow, the next day. It's just in the upper 30s, about 30. Oh, my gosh, it's 39 degrees, twice 19.5. Gentlemen, by the way, when we're doing this, if you have an interesting point or an observation or a question, kind of jump in because, you know, I don't want to miss any observations of this cutting-edge material, and I don't think we need in this age of clamor against political correctness to be totally politically correct. So, Will, please continue.
All right. So if you guys want to actually see that image there from the link, it's now under there. If you refresh the radio with pictures.
By the way, thanks to Keith and Rich for getting that up there so promptly.
Yeah, that was fast. Thank you, guys. You can actually pull it up and see how it works from how the LROC actually works and how fast it is. It's amazing how it can bring up these high resolution images so quick. And this actual anomaly is smack in the middle of it. If you're smack in the middle of the long ways where it's in the width. So if you're looking for it,
you click on the strip, right? And then it will give you an enlarged image.
Yep, you can start clicking on it. One click will make it a little bit bigger. One click will make the next click will make it a little bit bigger until you run out of resolution.
Oh, I see. Okay, okay. And you say it's right about in the middle.
Right about in the middle of both, yeah. And if you start looking for it, it's kind of a it's actually directly in the center, so you can't miss it coming down.
Now that's intriguing because that implies that they knew what was there and they actually targeted the strip to make it in the center.
You know, and in the actual the rationale description, it says target of opportunity.
Oh, that's so clever! Wow,
so
you're right. It's in the middle of nowhere. Now I do see something interesting toward the bottom right. It looks like it's a crater with something in the bottom of it, but it's kind of geometric in the bottom of it.
Yes,
and you can get lost for hours doing this, folks. So you know. Don't do this, you know, when we're on the air. Do this off the air because you'll get totally lost, and then you'll miss what we're going to say. So go ahead.
So that's where you get it from. You see, we didn't make that up, and I didn't – that wasn't even – you know, I took that directly from that. I didn't even enhance that image. So that image was taken directly from NASA. You can find it yourself.
Okay. Anybody else, Keith, Andrew, Bob, any comments on this really interesting find?
Yeah, they have those. You're right. You can get lost in these images. I mean, I have been lost in them for years and years, and they just keep getting better. All this LROC data, it's just sitting there, man. Hasn't been seen. Take a good look. If you've got areas of interest that you know of, you know, or someone in the past has talked about this particular anomaly, or this thing is here, or this thing is there, search out the coordinates and look it up. And on the LROC, they have a WMS map for LROC, which you can spin around and you can zoom into areas and find all the images that are in a specific area.
What is a WMS map?
It's a map that you can click on and bring up all the footprints.
What does WMS stand for?
I'm not really exactly sure what it stands for, but I know it works.
Okay.
And so, but I mean, it's like you know when you're Google Earth, you're Google. It's a map,
right? Okay.
You know, you pull it up, it's a whole planet, and you can search by coordinates, you can search by image number, you can search by you know, and it's cross referenced to all of it. But that's on the Apollo site that has been putting out all the great images. They're also tied in with the LROC site, so you can browse the new scanned Apollo images and the LROC images at the same time.
So they're cross-referenced. So you can look at the Apollo data, and then you can see the LRO data, which is taken 20, 30 years later. Actually, it's even taking them now, which is 40, 50 years later, and you can see the same thing after 50 years, 40 years, whatever, at much better resolution, I would think.
Well, you would think, but I happen to disagree with that because we have Apollo panoramic photos that are just stunning. I mean, yeah, the sub-meter res, and they're clear because of the technology that was used and the film that was used. They're so clear. But that's a matter for debate. Let's continue on with the anomalies.
Okay. Will?
All right. Richard, did you see that about sliding down the Skype channel a bit?
Yes.
All right. I saw they were giving us the go-ahead there. All right. The number four image there is just that little bitty, I called it a base, but it's just a little, looks like two little buildings that were next to it that had enough sun under it, the number four image. They're right next to it. You can actually see that to the bottom left-hand corner of each of the other images, except for the Apollo one. But we don't have to bring that one up. That was just one that I had sent over. And if we could go, thought, and I'll be done with my images here, and we'll go on to some of these other beautiful ones coming from comets and all around the solar system.
Mm.
We've been following Cirrus, the Lonely Mountain, the Hunamans.
Yes.
And we finally got some 240-mile data back.
So that's what number five is?
That's what number five is.
Okay. Other Side of Midnight. You can't lose people, because if we lose them, they'll kill us. OtherSideOfMidnight.com, upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures. Go slide down on Radio with Pictures page to number five. Click on number five, and you better be sitting down when you do this. Good grief.
There she is.
Oh, my God. Look at the geometry.
And it's finally come into play. It's they put it out in the mosaic. They didn't give us the actual, you know, single data on that point. But even the mosaic, that's why up in the top left-hand corner, I basically have cropped this image.
Right.
So that you can see that black part up in the corner. Don't mind that. That's just part of the mosaic where they didn't have photos for it. But even down in that crater next to it now, you can see a lot of detail.
Oh, my God. If you click on the image, double-click, in other words, you go to Radio with Pictures, click on 5, that gives you the image. Click on that image, and that brings up a stunning resolution version. Look at the top of that sucker.
And we've been speculating what it is, what it could be, what it couldn't be for months. And I'm so glad. It took a while to get this data back. I've been itching for it. So everybody on my channel has been itching for it. I'm going to do my next video on this tomorrow. But you can see the geometry. We talked about the back door from the last going in, how we had everything that we had seen is pretty much there from what I can tell. It looks like Andrew actually nailed it when he did his artist conception.
Absolutely. Look at on the – all right, if you take and assign a clock to the image, so midnight is straight up and 3 o'clock is on the right and 6 is the bottom and 9 is on the left. At 9 o'clock on the shadowed side of this dome – by the way, NASA's calling this a dome. Did you know that?
Yeah, that was in their actual
– In the actual caption, dome on Ceres. Ha ha, hint, hint, wink, wink. On that left-hand side, on the 9 o'clock position, the fluting, those straight things that go down, we now know because of the perspective shot that was taken months and months and months ago of this feature called a Hunamans on the horizon, we know the angle, the slope angle of those sides is about 45 degrees. So you've got these parallel flutes or ridges if we only had 10 times the resolution.
It's a shame. Hang on.
But we actually could. Because remember, the Dawn team is deciding now they're going to either leave the Dawn spacecraft orbiting Ceres, or like the Rosetta team, they're going to try to soft land it on Ceres, in which case, as they get lower and lower, as the orbit gets lower and lower, and they've got the ion engines so they can do that, we could get perspective shots, side-looking views, showing this thing as a real 3D object, and the resolution could get bigger and bigger. So we could get, 240 miles. If we got down to 24 miles, that would give us 10 times the resolution, and all they would have to do is shrink the orbit into a circular orbit to safely get some orbital shots of this object at that altitude before it crashes or they can actually kind of land it.
Yeah, with that ion engine, they might be able to just put it down softly from what they've been doing.
Well, that's what they did with the spacecraft at Eros. Remember years ago when they soft landed the Eros spacecraft on the surface of this other asteroid? And the Rosetta team, the European Rosetta team, is trying to do the same thing in a year or two with Rosetta. There's no reason why the Dawn guys couldn't, you know, give us some spectacular and very scientifically critical close-ups of this object before the spacecraft dies.
I suspect there's probably enough data at the moment that they could do a proper anaglyph of a Hunamans.
Well, that means you would need two images at least, spaced some time apart. I don't know what the orbital period.
I said that because on the this 3D shade from shape from shifting image that they've got up on their website, they've
shape from shading. I think you mean
yes.
shape from shifting and gets back to the campaign.
Yes. So yes, if you go to the to the image page for Dawn and go to the 3D image they've produced, on the page you go to below that, near at the bottom, there's an anaglyph.
Do we have a link, Bob? By the way, this is Bob Harrison who's talking to us, since he didn't say who he was.
I'll try and find it and I'll send it.
Okay, send it over to M, and then we'll post that under this image as well.
But it made me think that perhaps there's enough data, or there soon will be enough data to do an anaglyph from a proper 3D anaglyph from above. But I'll just go look for that now then, Richard.
Okay. And for people who wonder what an anaglyph is a red or green or red-blue image where you take two images and you make them stereo and you make one, eye version one color and the other eye version the other color. Then you put on these glasses, blue-green or blue-red glasses, and you look at the anaglyph image and the 3D pops out because each eye is processing the separate image separately because of the separate color.
And I know all of us still have these glasses laying around. It's amazing how often I pull them out. I go buy DVDs, like kid DVDs, that have four or five of them in there just to get them sometimes before Amazon. Now you can buy them directly on Amazon. For people who are interested in space and haven't gotten into the 3D versions that NASA put out, I recommend picking up some of the standard 3D glasses. And go in and checking out the anaglyphs that NASA puts out. Almost every spacecraft that uses them, and it's amazing what else you can pull out from this data. But I really wanted to show that. That was my contribution, because I tell you, I've been following this mission, and we've been waiting for these, and it's beautiful. We've speculated a lot about being a craft down there. Not really sure what it is, but it's got a heck of a lot of geometry. There looks like barbs going up the side of it with the slope. So, and there's nothing sitting at the bottom of it to have, boulders or something to have made these. I don't see the regolith. You don't see the boulders around the bottom of it that would have fallen down and even could make those girder looking pieces. And from this angle, we've seen these all the way around.
It's just astonishing, Andrew. Your thoughts?
Yeah, Richard, you made a really interesting point when you said NASA is now starting to call this a dome. They're actually calling it that.
Well, first of all, they call it a pyramid.
Yeah.
Isn't that kind of special? Now they're moving into calling it a dome. And by the way, all the geologists in NASA say, when asked what this thing is and how it could have been created, their uniform comment is basically, damn if I know. They haven't a clue what created this. At least publicly.
Right, exactly. And, part of the sort of NASA shadow puppeting that they do on the walls is, remember that series Flyby animation that I think you had posted on Other Side of Midnight? Might have been a couple months ago. And there was, do you guys remember that?
Keith?
Anybody? No.
You don't? I'm pretty sure you did post it, Richard, but if it's not, we should go back to it, because you were just, Richard, talking about how they're thinking about doing a soft landing like they did with Rosetta.
Mm-hmm.
And what was, again, with their shadow puppeting, or what I would say their foreshadowing, NASA seems to play these games constantly where they're putting out little Easter eggs for us to kind of like investigate.
Well, they've been doing that recently, and they've been giving us un-JPEG'd images and stunning close-ups like this. And I think it's part of a political, that word again, theory, strategy, which is when this all breaks, when the you-know-what hits the rotating kitchen, appliance, they will be able to point to this data and say, hey, we didn't hide anything, we put it all out there, and most of the public will basically buy the cover story. Only us nerds who know that from the beginning NASA's been doing everything but tell us the truth will realize that they've given us, about 99% you know, obfuscation, and 1% at that point real stuff. But everyone will focus on the 1%, and that's how they save their bacon, i.e. their budget, i.e. their careers, i.e. not going to Leavenworth.
Yeah. Well, I remember with that flyby, and I wish we could find it, because when in the animation we're sort of coming down low beside this structure, or this structure, what we think is a structure,
mm-hmm.
the thing was glowing in their animation. I mean, it looked like there was all kinds of internal geometry in that little animation, and I understand that it's just an animation. But again, it's that NASA foreshadowing. It's that putting it out there and preparing people for it. I mean, it was stunning when I saw it. I mean, it looked like it was internally lit, and it was stunning. I remember you had it up. But anyways,
I think we've got M going to find it, and we'll get Rich and Keith to put it up, and we'll put it under image number 5, because Bob's right. That's where it goes. And that way people can go back and forth between this high-res vertical shot looking straight down. Kind of looks like it's almost straight down. And then this 3D animation of the previous imagery, which gives you a simulated 3D view in perspective. And when you compare the two, that's where you're going to have your own ahas. And please, please be sitting down.
I just linked it for them.
Oh,
I found it.
Oh, cool.
So they can put that up. It's a YouTube video that NASA put out.
Excellent.
And it actually takes you right over. Takes you over Akator, too, which we are still waiting for the...
Okay, let me give you a little heads up on Akator. You know there's a big major NASA planetary science conference coming up, I think, on the 22nd, right?
The one in D.C.?
The one in Houston. Every year in March. This started back in the days of Apollo 11. When the Apollo 11 guys came back, the NASA scientists, who, of course, had all those experiments and were interested in the analysis of the rocks and all that, they set up the first lunar planetary science conference, which was henceforth called the Rock Conference, for scientists to talk about the moon initially, but then they branched it out so they can include anything, any images from any place in the solar system. So this year, the Dawn guys are promising big surprises when they show new data on and around the 22nd. So I think this is only a kind of a taste of what they're going to release in a couple of weeks.
Yes, you think we're going to be getting more. I'd be excited because I heard that they had gotten about 90% of it mapped and pictured, and that was still yet to come. So I'll be very excited to see what comes out in a couple of weeks. I think they're going with the SALT explanation. I'm pretty sure from what I've heard and what I've read. I don't know if anybody else has heard any different. But that seems to be what they're going with for the bright lights on the crater.
Yeah, the problem with that model is the closer they get and the better the pictures, if they don't jigger with them and they don't tell us something false, they're going to see all kinds of stunning geometry in Occiter, and that geometry is going to kind of cloud over, metaphorically speaking, the SALT hypothesis. Because why should SALT, coming up as hydrothermal vents in the middle of Occiter, why should the SALT take on stunning geometric properties?
And they've been totally geometric from the top looking down in.
Mm-hmm.
It's been every single shot when you look around the actual pieces too. So very excited. Now if we go ahead and refresh those pages, we can see that what Andrew had brought up.
Okay, so we've got now, Rich has posted the link, Ahunahman's Perspective, that's the flyby, under image number 5. So you'll see this dome, this pyramid, this, you know, one of the things we should have done, Keith, is to put maybe side-by-side a comparison of Nix, the moon, quote, moon orbiting Pluto. Because if Nix doesn't look like this in close-up, what else could it be? What else could it look like? Don't everybody speak at once?
Oh, yeah. Are you talking about, yes, it does look like Nix.
Yeah.
You know, we've looked at that before. It's the same general shape and, you know, it has the same general sort of striations, even though our view of Nix isn't really that great.
Not yet.
You can notice the similarities pretty much immediately, you know.
And again, this thing on Ceres, Ahunahman's, it's the only thing of its kind. It's like the last species, the last representative of an extinct species. How do you have a geological process that only produces one of something on a place that's relatively small? I mean, Ceres is, for those who may have forgotten, It's a sphere. It's a ball. It's 600 miles across. It's only twice the size of Connecticut.
Yeah, it's the only thing there that's in that nature. So yeah, it is an anomaly. Just in that perspective.
Yep.
But you know, it's even more an anomaly when you actually get to looking at it, because it's the strangest looking thing that, you know, the singular strangest thing on this planet, and one of the strangest things in the solar system.
And I think a tease of what's to come. I mean, how can they not tell us ultimately what it is if the data gets better and better and better, and the folks outside NASA, us included, start calling attention and making noise? Okay, so who's on first now?
Does it matter to me? We can go to Aristarchus and look around a little bit at some stunning stuff.
Okay, well, why don't we go in sequence? Because I see number six. Who's?
Yeah, that's who's, Andrews.
Andrew? Okay.
Wonderful.
Okay, yeah, here I am. Sorry, I was just talking.
There you are.
Hi,
those little cat naps are really refreshing at this time of night, aren't they?
Hey, we're talking about your stuff, man.
Well, I fell in love with Comet 67P.
You too, huh?
Yeah.
Yes.
The more I looked at this thing,
so everybody, you know, click on number six and then click on it again if you want a large, and you can use your cursor arrows and go up and down and sideways and all that. So image number six.
Yeah, and I'm going to try this. So it's Churyumov Gerasimenko.
Wonderful. Henceforth called 67P.
Yeah, exactly. That's the first and last time I try that. And yeah, so it was a so-called comet discovered in 1969 by the Soviet astronomers. And in the European Space Agency launched the Rosetta spacecraft in, I think it was 2004. And then chase this thing because it goes on an elliptical orbit between Jupiter and the Earth.
And yeah, and the whole orbital chase is depicted on the right-hand graphic.
Yeah, exactly. And then they caught up to it in I think, 2014.
August of 2014, yes.
Yep. And it was apparently the first comet that we've ever put we've done a soft landing, which wasn't so soft, with the Philae lander. And I think, Richard, in your entry into Pluto, Lost Horizons for New Horizons for Lost Horizons, you have some imagery in there too,
yes,
of this comet, especially some of the close-up stuff right on the comet cliff, or one of the cliffs that they landed on. So people should go to that. So the size, just really quickly go through this. It's a pretty big object. It's the size is right there, probably 2.5 miles on its big lobe. It's a double-lobed object. The mainstream believe that it was slowly fused together over time. I'm not sure how that process works. I believe, as we've been talking about and discussing in this model, that it's one object and that it's not two.
And I think it's one object that has some striking, stunning geometry. It's been beaten to hell in a handbasket, and so now you see the remnants, kind of like the under structure. So the lobey parts kind of stick out, but all the wonderful geometry that would be on top of this basic, you know, geometry has long gone.
Yeah.
And let's not mince words. This thing looks like an exploded Death Star.
Yeah.
Let's not mince words. This thing looks like the remains of a large craft.
Yeah.
If you scroll
down on that number, what number am I on?
Number six. Number six?
Yeah. So if you can go to Radio with Pictures and scroll down to the bottom, there's I grabbed this off the internet, Austin, Texas, a little representation of what this thing would look like in its, you know, if it was sort of embedded into the Earth. So anyways, let's go back to Radio with Pictures, and I'd like everybody to go to link number 13. And the reason I want you to go here is just so everybody can get a sense of what this thing looks like when it's sort of hurtling and tumbling through space.
Ah, okay.
So it's a little animation.
Link 13.
13.
Is an animation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a pretty quick little animation.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's way cool.
Way cool.
Yeah, so that's the kind of, you know, that's what the Rosetta probe would have been seeing as it was approaching this thing.
As it was approaching.
Yeah.
By the way, Em, can we find the 67P music? I want to post the link to the music, because if you listen to the music, the actual radio tones coming from this thing, which the Rosetta team put out the day before they were landing the little probe, the Philae probe from Rosetta on this object, they released this soundtrack of astonishing comet music, and it's not normal. So I'd like to have that on the same page, somewhere around the comet images, so people can click on the actual radio frequency data coming from the comet, and it sure sounds mechanical.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Richard, because I know you use this term a lot, but the data points. When we go through this stuff, and I know we're going to go to break soon, but when we sort of progress, and I promise to go quickly through it, there's just too many data points that point towards this thing being artificial. And the music just adds to the whole, you know, timbre of this thing. Now, can I go to link 7, or do you want to cut out now?
Probably. I'll tell you what, let's leave it here. We'll play a little extra music. I'm going to go with Bobby Bright tonight, because we didn't do Bobby last night. We did Rich Riggs, and everybody said to me in their emails, what happened to Bobby Bright? In fact, this is Riggs. So we'll go with Riggs. You're on the other side of midnight, as the song says. Our panel will be right back, as will I. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Jupiter from the pyramids at Giza, you've arrived at the Club 19.5. Club 19.5. Club 19.5.
And we are back on the other side of midnight with our imaging team this morning. By the way, guys, I'm going to kind of mix and match because I have a whole bunch of other people that I know who do imaging, very good imaging, and they've been saying to me, but you haven't brought us on to talk about this stuff. So we're going to kind of, you know, bring some more folks on because I want everyone to know that everybody that you hear talking about this stuff has arrived at these conclusions independently. We haven't all been in touch for all these years. We've looked at this data, we've independently done our assessments, and we've come to essentially the same conclusion, and that's what makes science. If you come to an independent, you know, similar conclusion to the other guy or other gal, then you know that you're probably pretty much on to what's going on. So, Andrew, please continue.
Okay, so if we go
By the way, let me interrupt one thing. I noticed you'd chosen Austin because Senator Cruz won Texas, and Senator Cruz is head of the Senate Space Committee, which oversees NASA. That's why you chose Austin, right? Right? Right?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay, so if we go to link 7.
Got it.
This is – okay, now this one I'll go quickly through because it came from the last time we had looked at
castles.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to bring this up. The image at the top is, again, from the ESA, the European Space Agency website, which, by the way, there is a link on Other Side of Midnight, Radio with Pictures, I think near one of my – well, we'll go back to it. But because hey, for everybody out there, I don't label my photographs that come from the space agency, so I'm still learning myself because I've been so obsessed doing the art. But now that I'm putting the side-by-sides, I think that I should take that next step. So there's a little edit for me. But one of the things we didn't get a chance to talk about, again, if we go to this, is just kind of click a little bit larger. And if you go over to the right-hand side, on the upper right-hand side, you'll see these castles, this one called Alt Dan Castle in Germany. And this is from Keith's website, The Hidden Mission. And I would recommend everybody at some point go and have a look at his link into his castle work. So I'm giving Keith a little plug here. Not that he needs it. But,
thank you.
But, you know, he comes to this from a very honest place, much like Bob, because Bob grew up with this stuff, with the old ruins. But these guys can really see this stuff through the, you know, the glimmer of nature and how nature erodes and reclaims all this stuff back. You know, Bob being from England, and in fact, you know, Keith did a lot of growing up, I think, in Germany, right, Keith?
Sure did.
Yeah. So he was surrounded by this really magical place. But what I wanted to show was, look at the way the castle just erodes over time from the rain, the wind, the sun, just the elements that you know, hit it.
You mean the terrestrial castle, the one on the right?
The
color images on the right, okay.
Exactly. And Richard, could you give us a little explanation of the kind of things that would happen to if this is a spacecraft like we think? What kind of erosion or, you know, like effects would happen in outer space as it's whipping around our solar system.
Well, if we go to Keith's model, which I pretty much think is right, this thing originally was a 2.5, maybe 3.5 mile wide, highly geometric spacecraft with all kinds of underlying geometric order, because you can't create a machine without some kind of understructure, something that holds the stuff all together, particularly if you have thrust applied to it, and if these things could move under their own power. And then on top of that, you would have had filigree, you would have had buildings, you would have had bubbles and domes and antennas and all kinds of stuff. And then something shatteringly important happened. If we're saying this is a casualty of the Great War, the big war millions of years ago with this extraordinary Type II civilization, lobbing weapons at each other that we can only imagine, the first major hit would have maybe eroded, a half a mile down, because it would have vaporized it. And then over the subsequent millions of years, you have the debris from the explosion of a planet, planet 5 in the solar system, planet 4, I'm sorry, and that debris in the form of fine particulate matter hitting objects at miles per second is basically like a hypersonic sandblasting. So the tiny stuff is what does the rest of the damage. It erodes, it degrades, it sandblasts, it continues to grind the surface, like driving across the Sahara in a Mercedes in a sandstorm, and you wind up with structure, but structure which is almost unrecognizable to the uneducated eye unless you understand what you should be looking for, which is geometry, which will still, under all that bombardment and destruction, still emerge as a kind of a template if you can see past the details and the noise and the debris.
So that's perfect. That segues perfectly right into 8. So if we go back to Radio with Pictures,
okay,
and go to our link 8, or my link 8.
Got it.
Okay, so, and then just enlarge that.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. My God. Look
that's
what
cool.
You're seeing.
Yeah.
Holy, Andrew, your eye is phenomenal, because yes, this is like, look, if you build big stuff in space or on Earth or wherever, you have to build it in a way that it conforms to basic natural physical law.
Yeah.
And hexagonal structures are the hallmark of A, hyperdimensional torsion field physics. They're the hallmark of things we've seen at Cydonia. They're the hallmark of Bucky Fuller's work. Remember Bucky Fuller and geodesic domes
exactly.
And all that?
Yep.
Because structurally, that's how you make a big structure strong. And look what you found. Oh, my God.
Didn't I tell you it was an exploded Death Star?
Now, how do you guys think this happened? Do you think that a civilization would find an actual asteroid and mine it?
These are built. No. Remember, our whole idea of asteroids as pieces of rock comes from the model. It either comes from an exploded planet model or from it's the debris that Jupiter wouldn't let form a planet model. But the idea that asteroids are really natural, rocky, bergy bits comes from our approach. If in fact you say this was a Type 2 civilization and they remade the matter in the solar system into the form of artificial material, when you get enough big scale, natural stuff and artificial stuff will look the same because they erode the same.
It makes sense.
Well, what's really interesting is if you slowly scroll down this is not just a few pictures.
Mm-mm.
Anybody can go to the European Space Agency website and go to the Comet 67P, and you will find these polygons all over this structure in all kinds of places. You don't even need to have a trained eye, just like you can see here. But one of the interesting things was if you scroll down to the bottom of this link to number 4, and you look on the left-hand side, and there's a pit. And the scientists were calling this sinkholes. They apparently discovered 18 sinkholes all around this comet. And they measured anywhere from several hundred to several thousand feet in diameter.
Yep.
And so they are admitting that this thing has cavities. It has spaces inside. Now, their explanations for why that is ranges from it was ice and then it was just heated up and then gassed out, so the empty spaces are left over. And some ideas were, there were empty spaces right from the beginning. And then there's other ideas that, well, gases expand and contract inside this, creating big voids. But the point is that they're admitting that there are spaces. And isn't this similar to Phobos, Richard? Wasn't there a...
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the difference is that there is an experiment on the Rosetta spacecraft that was supposed to communicate with Philae, the little lander, and basically send radio beams, radio signals from the lander to Rosetta mothership. And I don't know whether it went both ways, but at least it went one way. And the idea was to use the changing orbit of Rosetta as it orbits, flies around this object, and the fixed position of the little Philae lander, wherever it was, and even if they didn't know exactly where it was, they could still pick up this radio signal while the battery, the big battery, lasted those 65 hours. And so they were able to get a kind of a radio profile of the interior of this object. And I expected, like Phobos and the European Space Agency's ESA spacecraft, Mars Express, that we would get big hollow voids inside. And 67P does not seem to have hollow voids inside. It appears to be solid or more solid on the inside than on the outside, which means, who was it who said, I guess maybe Bob, who asked if this could have been a modified asteroid in the classical asteroid sense. And, yeah, that data would tend to indicate maybe this thing wasn't built through and through, but we actually have such little data from Philae before the battery died that we don't really have a complete interior scan. So I'm not sure whether that preliminary conclusion by the ESA team will hold up.
Right, okay. Well, it's interesting nonetheless, and there are definitely holes in it, that's for sure.
Well, but it doesn't have to. In other words, if it's built, you know, why would you build something that's hollow all the way through if you don't have to?
Yeah,
in other words, if we're looking at modifying a, quote, natural object,
right.
For instance, this might not have been, again, this is where data takes you in a different direction. This object, 2.5 miles, is not very big in space to build something with sufficient technology. This could have been an object built after the Great War by some of the succeeding civilizations, and they could have used fragments of the exploded planet as a base on which to build all kinds of artificial stuff in geometric form, including what we're seeing on 67P. In other words, we won't know again until everybody together, we find the libraries.
One of the interesting things about this comet is that from certain angles where you're seeing the whole object, you're getting geometry so we've got sort of like this hexagonal geometry grid in sub-image 3, which I'd recommend to listeners, but far away shots, you're getting, if you see it from the smaller end of the comet, looking down the length of it, the duck's head, as they call it,
mm-hmm.
has a vaguely hexagonal outline. It's some angles where you've got the body and the head, and the neck is in shadow. Both of them, both the body and the head, will look roughly rectangular. The body of the, you know, compare it to being like a rubber duck. If you see that from the bottom, it's vaguely rectangular again. The outline, the silhouette of it. If it's artificial, it's been more geometrical than we see it now, and it's
That's why I think a lot of it is now missing.
Yeah, very deeply eroded. Well, the neck has been formed by a huge chunk of it being, by the looks of it, being knocked out, hasn't it? It's like a huge bite taken out of it. It's really caused the neck between the two parts.
Unless, and this is one idea I just was kind of casually thinking about in my spare time when I casually think about things that most people don't want to think about. If you think of this thing as a mega, mega version of the Enterprise with the saucer section and the connecting, I forget what that section is called, down to the engineering section and the nacelles, if you eroded everything away and all you were left with was a fragment of the saucer section of the Enterprise and a fragment of the engineering section. The nacelles are gone, and the neck, that blade, that fin connecting the saucer and the engineering section is all that's left. And then you erode it and erode it and erode it. That's kind of like what this thing could have been originally, which, of course, would be very intriguing, because then it means that Gene Roddenberry, instead of magically creating the Enterprise geometry out of his imagination, he may have actually seen a document or seen something from someone somewhere that gave him a hint that this is the geometry that you build in space.
And so many of these small objects have this two-part effect, don't they? Like Comet Hartley 2,
yep.
Wasn't it?
Hydra.
Yep. Yeah, there's quite a few asteroids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a small part and a large part apparently joined together with a neck. So there's been quite a few of them now of this kind of layout.
I'm just stunned by this hexagonal geometry. Did you guys ever see a film called Silent Running?
Oh, yeah.
Remember the space view of the ship that was going to preserve the ecospheres and all the domes, kind of like fish eyes or fly's eyes or bee's eyes seen from afar? Can you imagine that this thing might have been studded with these domes, hexagonal domes?
Oh, boy.
The image is mind-boggling to what we've lost and what has been hidden. And now, for some reason, both the Europeans and the Americans are giving us better data to actually figure out what this thing and these things might really be.
It's stunning.
So where are we? Tempest is fugiting, so we're at 8:15 the hour.
Yeah, okay, so we'll go quickly to 9. So we'll go back to radio with pictures, go to link 9, and...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Go ahead.
Last year in October, the scientists were stunned, and they announced that basically there were four major gases, and being sort of ejected or
gassed. We're talking composition now of what's coming out from inside 67P.
Yeah. As it was getting close to the sun and being hit by this, the solar winds and the radiation, it would just start to, I guess, tear apart the surface of this thing, the layers.
Mm-hmm.
And most
that's the model. Okay, that's their model. I have a different model.
And apparently most of what is being gassed out is oxygen, and they were absolutely stunned.
Because how do you get free oxygen in a billions and billions of year old comet that's been a frozen iceberg from the origin of the solar system? And we know oxygen doesn't hang out free. It combines with everything. We really don't see very many places astrophysically in the universe, in the galaxy, where free oxygen exists, because it so readily combines with other stuff. So how does most of the gases coming out of this comet retain its molecular oxygen character?
Yeah. And the other gases, the other elements coming out were water,
yep,
carbon monoxide, and carbon dioxide. So, Richard, your model is that we're looking at internal artificial atmospheres.
Exactly. We're looking at the ecosystem degrading over time. And if you look down on the close-up of, what is it, number 9 or 10? Which image are we on?
We're on number 9.
9, okay. If you go to number 9, click on it. Click on it again.
Yep.
The center panel under your top two, where you have the three,
yep.
You see that incredible jet?
Yes.
Why is that jet focused?
Exactly.
Keep in mind, in space, gases will expand as a hemisphere in all directions because there's a vacuum, and anything with temperature will expand random, Boltzmann motion of molecules or atoms. You'll get basically a sphere of diffusing gas. Why is that a highly collimated jet?
Because it's coming out of the small pockets.
Yeah, don't all talk at once now. Anybody want to make a guess?
It's probably because it's coming out of those small pockets.
No.
You get me? It's got little sails in
sorry,
there.
Sorry, sticks. Sorry, sorry. No, no,
that?
No.
What do you think?
Keith's pocket model is not right. Bob? Bob?
What do you think then, Richard?
Oh, come on.
I have...
Andrew?
Well, it's got to come from a compressed place.
You're getting close.
Yeah.
Okay. Will?
I'd say they'd have to come from inside something compressed, something pushing it out, exhaust. The
Okay, you're so close. Plumbing. We're looking at plumbing. We're looking at pipes. We're looking at, you know, it's like a rocket. It's like an artificial rocket because the gases only can come out through the pipe. And when they come out, they're collimated like a rocket.
Oh, Richard, that's perfect. This is – I don't know how you do this, but you are a mystic, man.
Okay. No, I'm a scientist. I know the physics and I know that – and again, you can't create this kind of collimation by warming a spot on the surface of a Burgi bit, you know, in the snowball model of Fred Whipple. You can't get this collimation. It's got to be mechanical collimation from deep down, and there are – images of this comet taken on the night side where totally out of reach of the sun, in darkness, in shadow, where the temperatures would be hundreds of degrees below zero, you get this collimated jet effect coming suddenly on one image and then disappearing several images later. That only happens if the energized process is kind of like a wave. The heat is going through the object, warming up your compressed reservoirs, guys, of gases on the interior, and then when they get warm enough, they either evaporate and then evaporate in the direction of the flow of the pipe, and they come out where the pipe is open, where it's been cut off and open to space, and bingo, there you have a jet.
So it's like a gun.
Yeah, yeah, a slow motion gun. Very slow motion.
Well, someone that is doing a lot of plumbing around the house lately, I'm at that 13-year point. That's exactly how it comes out when you bust a pipe.
You got it.
But, Richard, the reason why I said mystic is because if we go back to radio with pitchers and we now move on to I'd like to now move on to number 11 because of what you just said.
Got it.
So please go to number 11. And then
click on it again. That gives you the big view. Oh, my gosh. Look at that geometry.
Yeah. Yeah, and listen, on this thing, I could spend 100 years, like, you know, creeping around this monster. But I chose one little section here, and if you scroll down with my little arrow, I tried to blow it up a little bit to keep its integrity.
Okay.
And what you start to see are pipes. You start to
see. Yeah.
So if you go to my little illustration.
Which is the last one on the page at the very bottom.
I am trying to be very faithful to what I'm seeing here. You're seeing, again, geometry. You're seeing destruction. You're seeing piping. You're seeing support structures. There are so many little circles and hexagons just repeating. But you have to go – again, everybody, if you go to the European Space Agency site and go and look at these images and zoom in on this stuff, you will see this over and over again.
In the raw data.
Yes,
or absolutely. Kind of close to raw because they do a little processing, but they don't really. Now, by the way, in that first image on the upper of number 11, the first one where you have the black rectangle and the arrow down.
Yes.
Look over on the far left.
Well, yeah, the whole top of that thing is covered. It's
and
covered.
Then look below what's on the far left. You see the jet?
Yeah.
It looks like coming
it's
right up there.
Escaping plumbing. And it's big plumbing. I mean, we're talking viaduct size plumbing here, not household plumbing. We're talking mega plumbing for an object 2.5 miles wide. But without plumbing, how do you get materials to people? How do you recycle? Because obviously you're recycling. In other words, plumbing is the foundation of civilization.
Yeah. Now I want to get back to radio with pictures because I want to scoot away here so we can get Keith on.
Yep.
Please go to link 12.
Link 12.
And then that's just a little bit a better version of my illustration.
Okay.
Of
Oh, wow. So, click on it. Click on it. Yes.
Click on that. And again, there's the circular and polygonal type openings all over the place. An incredible structure.
Geometry, 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 geometry. God, people are going to get sick of me saying geometry, but that's how you tell this stuff is real and artificial. Geometry. Nothing else by this remote sensing other than some of the interpretation of the spectral data. But remember, the spectral data alone would fit a natural model. You could say, oh, there's a weird place where oxygen doesn't combine with stuff because it was frozen instantly, etc., that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But when you look at the plumbing and see where it's coming from, you put the two data parts together, bingo, your analysis says it's got to be artificial.
And so to me, these look like decaying decks.
Yes.
They just absolutely look like that. Now, I want to show one more picture, and this was one that intrigued me, and then I'll quickly step aside. So please go back to Radio with Pictures, everybody.
Okay.
And I want you to go to link number – oh, isn't that funny? Link number 10.
Number 10.
And so it's I call this elegant design E. Okay, on one side of the comet, there is something I find absolutely incredible. There are repeating curvilinear lines, and I mean these. I put a little box around it. Yeah,
like chevrons.
Yeah, and they are almost exactly the same size, and they are bracketing each other. I mean, I could see this maybe happening once in nature, but twice beside each other
and side by side.
Side by side and almost the same dimensions. I mean, I did some tracings and laid it over top. And to me, again, if you scroll down and look at my little interpretation of it, it is stunning. It's almost Art Nouveau in its style. Just, I mean, I don't know what this is. Whether this would have been like an internal, you know, travel tube, or some, or maybe it was an engine room, or maybe again, Richard, maybe it's plumbing. But it is,
or it could be art.
Yes, it could be an insignia on the outside of this thing.
It's in the original event, if this object goes back to the Great War 65 million years ago when somebody blew up a whole planet and the shrapnel came shredding out, if the blast wave crossed this object, wherever it was hanging out, and by the way, we know the orbit has changed. It used to be out, you know, beyond Jupiter, and an encounter with Jupiter relatively recently, last 150 years, kind of brought it into the current orbit. So this thing was in the cold and in the dark beyond Jupiter, and at that distance, if the blast wave only crossed once, in other words, you have one side facing the blast and one side facing away, right? Yeah. So the side facing the blast, like with Pluto, where I think one side was stripped down, the side with the heart, and the other side, the Trantor surface, is much better preserved because it was hiding in the blast shadow. If this object, this feature, these two features were on the shadow side, then that's why even on the surface they would have been better preserved, and so we're only dealing now with the random micrometeorite abrasion as opposed to the first blast wave of the major explosion.
Interesting. Well, for me, this was the kicker. This, I fell in love with this thing even more just because of this design. To me, it looks like a very intelligent design.
Well, you know, from some angles, Bob, let's go back to your interpretation. I hate to say it, but the whole visage of 67P looks like a huge sphinx, an incredibly eroded sphinx. And you got to look at the approach imagery before we had all the detail, and as it rotates around to maybe pause that animation we have linked now, and look at certain angles, certain perspectives, this thing looks like a huge sphinx. Do you remember a film, guys, called Zardoz?
No.
With Sean Connery?
Yes.
And what was the big MacGuffin in Zardoz? A huge anti-gravity floating head. A sphinx-like head, right?
Yep.
If you're dealing with a technology where individuals can control the energies of entire current terrestrial countries, and ultimately the human ego is everything, would you build your spacecraft? Imagine you're an ancient Donald Trump, and you wouldn't build just Trump Tower. You would redesign an entire visage of yourself orbiting the sun with people visiting and whatever commerce and all that. But every time someone came up to your space habitat, there you are, 2.5 miles wide. Think Egypt. Think Abu Simbel. Think what humans do when they have enough power to do anything they want.
Like the carving on top of Candor tetrahedron.
Yes, you know. Exactly, precisely.
And Richard, you're exactly right. There is a beautiful image that literally looks like the profile of a face. I mean, I don't, you know, I was going, is this pareidolia? Or am I looking at?
That's the first question, but you can't overlook anything. And when you're dealing with something of this majesty and scope and scale, and the sheer power of the civilization that did this, nothing is impossible.
And on that note, I'm done.
Okay. All right. We only got a minute to the bottom of the hour. Do you want to do a setup, Keith? Hello, folks.
Hey.
Oh, there
I'm
you
still
are.
Here.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, the eroding decks and so forth that are on number 12 segue right into my material.
Okay.
And so it worked excellently. If you want to go to a break, that's fine.
Yeah, we better go to a break so we have a full half hour at the bottom here. So what I'm going to do is I've been playing some music that I've been finding in our music gallery. Remember, folks, we love people to contribute music. We love people to send us all their art and all their music, and then we will play it. So this is another of Lee Culprit's songs. Again, quite appropriate, How Much to Mars? And you can think about the meaning of that term in any way you like. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. The Gang of Four is with me tonight, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight, one half hour to go for this episode. I have sent M on a mission to find a full moon version, full moon image of the moon. Because if we start talking about a place called Aristarchus, no one's going to know where Aristarchus is or the fact that they can look up on any night almost when the moon is up, and particularly if it's full or it's, you know, a waning crescent, waning gibbous, waning crescent. On the upper left-hand side, there will be this intensely bright region called Aristarchus, after an ancient Greek philosopher who basically defined our cosmology and our visions of the heavens for thousands of years until we kind of broke out of that little bubble. It's kind of ironic that the most intriguing mega-object you can see on the moon from the Earth that turns out also not to be natural, as you're going to hear about momentarily, is in fact on our own moon and is named after this guy, Aristarchus, who kept us in bondage, kind of intellectual bondage, for several thousand years before we realized the universe we really live in. So, Keith, while we're waiting for the full moon image, take it away.
Okay, if you go to Radio with Pictures and click on link number 15.
Got it.
It's a colored picture of Aristarchus. Okay, it leads to my page of Aristarchus. And we're looking at image number one on my page, and it's a kind of purple color. You can see Aristarchus Crater. It's the bright object at the very bottom of the square that's in the middle of this image.
A very weird square.
And that's a telescope image. Aristarchus is kind of like in the northwestern quadrant, if you're looking up at the full moon.
Yeah, upper left-hand corner.
It's kind of in the upper left-hand corner, yes. And it's a large square area, and it's about 80 miles, I think, on a side, maybe a little bit larger than that. It's the home of lunar transit phenomena, LTP.
Yeah, now we have to define that.
That's bright lights that people have noticed over the centuries emanating from the moon. When they're looking at it with their telescope, and they'll see a bright flash of light or, haze or, any kind of anomalous phenomenon. This place has been the home of the most of it.
Well, Sir William Herschel, who was one of the giants of one of your countrymen, Bob, when he looked at Aristarchus with his first big reflecting telescopes, when it was not in sunlight, when it was in the moon's shadow, he reported, and you can go and Google, Sir William Herschel and Aristarchus lights, he discovered that he could see what he called smoldery red embers, something that looked like an ancient dying campfire in Aristarchus, even when it was in total darkness, in shadow, lit only by the light of the Earth. So Aristarchus has been a very weird place for a very long period of time, and now, Keith, you found some more stuff out about it.
Oh, yes. If you look the second image, number two, these are Clementine images of it. And, Clementine was this great multispectral camera that we put in there in the late 70s pretty much mapped the entire moon. It's supposed to have been at a very high-res level, but we didn't get very good images of it.
It was a military. It was a Navy satellite.
Yes, it was a Navy satellite, and it was totally quiet.
Totally. In fact, it was so quiet. I mean, this was the first time Clementine went back to the moon after Apollo. It was the first spacecraft to go back to the moon after Apollo, after 20 years. And the night that they launched it en route to the moon, President Bill Clinton happened to be giving a State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress, and he never even mentioned it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Clementine image, all these images, if you click on them, it brings up larger versions of it. Yep. But this gives us an idea of the content that's down there, the materials that are down there. And you can see that Aristarchus Crater is vastly different than the rest of the Aristarchian plain there, the larger square area,
which is different than
the plane that it's sitting on.
So the colors correspond to different elements, different materials?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, and mostly the red normally stands for mafic materials. Okay,
meaning, come on,
the stuff that like volcanic materials that have covered stuff up. The blues and stuff. The blues and the greens are generally titanium and silicon.
You're kidding.
So you see where I'm leading with what Aristarchus actually is. Okay. Aristarchus is actually a dome.
Now, ancient lunar artificial city under a glass dome.
Yes, and it is burst, and its pieces are all over the plain beside it, and its ruins are all inside it. The devastation was pretty complete, and let's scroll down a little bit. There are things that are on this plain, though, around Aristarchus that are not so destroyed. Number three is one of these.
So we're we're still on your page.
Yes, we're still on our page. Okay. Just go down to image number three, and that is a dome that is still pretty much intact. It's north of Aristarchus Crater, just about maybe 10 miles or so. But this is one of the things that litter this plain. Number three and number four are, and they both opened up into huge images. And if you click on number three and open up that huge image, there's going to be some surprises for you.
Okay, let's not go too fast. All right, clicking on three. Mm-hmm. Then I click on it again.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, this is a full-res lunar reconnaissance orbiter image of the area, about 10 miles north of Aristarchus Crater, and it's a dome there. You see the striations that are all over this thing.
Yeah.
These are the eroded decks, the things like Andrew was talking about. If you look in the bright – there's a bright area that is to the left. I know this is a huge image now, you know, but that's how these images are coming, and that's how we have to take them. Being so, you have to study in detail the things that are on them because they're right up in our face, and they're at the resolution that – the things that are on there are not tricks of light and shadow. They are there. And we have in the bright area, we have the same sort of polygonal shapes and girders and striations.
Almost reminds me of a Hunamans.
Exactly. Well, these are the kind of things that are all over, you know, they're all over the moon. They're especially all over this Aristarchian area because I think the whole square area was probably some type of huge base back in the day, with the crater dome being sort of like maybe the capital or the main place of this area. But you can see plainly, though, that this is an artificial object. It's covered up. It's buried up. It's eroded. It's just like the things that we see on 67P. It's sort of like the things that we see on Ceres and on Pluto and especially on Mars, too.
But you can get there in 3 days.
Yes, this is right.
You can get there with a Google spacecraft or a SpaceX spacecraft, or in other words, this is within our reach, within our technology, within our budget, within our grasp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right there. It's looking at us. I mean, it's looking at us every night, you know. Okay, well, we'll click out of that image.
Okay.
If you would, and go back, and number four is the same way.
Wonderful. The guys have done it again. Okay. If you go back to Radio with Pictures, next to 15, next to the image that Keith's talking about, on the far right-hand side of that strip, you'll see a full moon. It's kind of rotated. Aristarchus is the bright thing at about, again, using clock. If top is midnight, if bottom is 6 o'clock, it's about 8 o'clock and in from the edge, in from the limb. At about 8 o'clock on that image, that full moon image, that's Aristarchus as you see it, looking at it from the Earth with your naked eye. Keith?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll go back to that picture, and we'll see, on number four, and we have another one of these domes, and this is right beside the one that's above it. Then, like I say, about 10 miles or so, about 10 miles north of Aristarchus Dome.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's if you click on that to that full image, this one has been preserved really well. And you see the striations there. This is structure.
Tell people why this has to be structure, why it's not landslides, or why it's not some kind of geological faulting.
if you want to know, look, just scroll down the image a little further, and you'll get a you'll see an actual area of Mare that's just undisturbed and natural. Okay, it's just plain. It's crater pock. There's no striations on it.
I'm seeing 3D geometry on the close-up now.
Exactly. It's all over these mounds, and they're all over Aristarchus. They're fairly frequently found all over the moon.
I was just going to say, you understand what you're saying, don't you?
Oh, yes, I understand exactly what I'm saying.
That the moon itself, a lot of the moon we see is not natural. It's been built. The surface is the remnants of built superstructure, which now is incredibly intensely degraded.
Mm-hmm. The same way. I mean, and this is pretty well-preserved stuff. And the better that the imagery gets, and it has gotten so much better.
From NASA, you mean?
The easier it is to access, the more of this kind of stuff we'll see, because it's so easy to find this. All you have to do is go through that WMS map, search for a particular area that's your favorite, and look, it's there. The images are wide open for us. Most of them, they're untouched. So, you know, we have people that worry about stuff being edited, and, you know, will they blur stuff out? Oh, yeah? Well, look at this image I just showed you. I found it right in the public archives.
It's steamboat time.
Yes, it's time to look at these. It's time to actually take a, you know, everybody, you know, pull out your computer, go there, find out how to reference these images.
Okay, let's move on. Time is flitting.
Okay, then number five is what I call the Cheez-It. If you go out back to my page and click on image number five, it's what I call the Cheez-It. It's a large square thing that's halfway buried in
it. This, of course, is named after Keith's famous football snack.
But and if you look up to right below the Cheez-It, there is more structural. There's more structural stuff that's down toward the bottom of the image. And, you know, these will be up here. Feel free to come back and look at them anytime or on my site on that page, you know, if you want to study them. Because we got to move on, because we got some better stuff on down the page a little bit. I want everybody to see. And if you go back to my page on image number six, this is a multispectral image of the actual dome up close from Clementine.
Okay.
Now what this is, hang on.
This blue circle with the greens and the other stuff kind of overhanging it, that's the Aristarchus crater. Looking straight down at the Aristarchus crater, which I believe is between 60 and 80 miles across. I forget the exact number. And the stuff in the center, they think, is an uplift rebound, Central Peak Mountains and all that. But the whole thing is chemically, mineralogically, compositionally, totally different than the surrounding area.
Yes, it is, and it's spread out over the area surrounding it. Do you see to the northwest?
Yep.
But everywhere else, it's the Mare around it. So, all right. Well, that leads us to, let's look in this thing, because we've got some stunning images of this, and I'm going to tell you what, I've got a big image here, number seven. Looking in the crater. Yes. Scroll down a little bit from number six, and there we have the crater, and that's Apollo Pan image. Apollo 15-0331. Okay, and this is one of the wonderful images that were scanned from the original films.
This is part of that project at the University of Arizona, right?
Yes, and each one of the individual tiles that this huge panoramic image is made out of is 2 gigabytes. They open up. They are wall-sized images.
Look at the terracing. People have usually thought that was just slumping of surface materials. That looks like it's remaining structure that's still resisting erosion.
And we'll click that image, and it opens up about a quarter res image of the actual size image, but it's still stunning. I couldn't put the whole image on here. Good Lord, I don't have that kind of bandwidth. But the larger image, you can look around, and you see this image. The one that I view out of, the one that I hunt anomalies on, is about 8 times this size. I can see things walking around down there. Were they there? And this is the area that I am studying right now. I have to really put in due diligence, because the stuff that's down here is important. I mean, it is really important, and it's important that it's presented properly and correctly and is shown in the best possible manner, because what is down here is stunning and will rock our world.
Wow.
I mean, just from this image here, if you're clicked onto the large image and you're looking around, you can just about tell what I'm talking about. It's just a little far out to make out perfect detail, but there are structures and there are eroding things and there are beams and there are chunks of glass laying down in the bottom of this thing.
Wow.
Yeah. That there may even be activity going on within this thing.
Well, see, that was one of the questions that John Greenacre, I think he was an astronomer at Lowell back in the 60s, who was viewing the so-called lunar anomalies, and Aristarchus was high on the list. And in fact, there's an official NASA list somewhere of all the weird lights on the moon, the so-called lunar anomalies over the last couple hundred years, and Aristarchus is at the top of the list in terms of weird activity. He never got what it was. I mean, people were thinking outgassing, you know, internal whatever. But suppose Aristarchus was the most recently destroyed of the ancient lunar cities, and in fact the shimmering lights, the reddish glows and all that, are still from fires that have still been burning after millions of years because of the huge quantity of oxygen and other flammable materials that were released during the war, during the impact?
Yeah, well, you know, I've looked at the up close images, and yeah, you know, I wish I could share a little bit of them. Maybe that's for a later show, because I'm going through and detailing all the fine items that are within this area. You know, I didn't really see any fires, but I'm telling you, there are large chunks of reflective materials. There are items laying around that look like machinery. There are items around that look like defunct ships. And I wish everybody could see it, but within this image, that's not going to happen.
We will come back. Don't worry. Yes, we will come back to this.
On fine scale, it is here. And we have images of every anomalous place that we have ever seen that are like this, that are the same quality, that are the same sub-res, super spy images that the iTech Pan camera took. They're just stunning. I don't think LROC, I don't think even with the technology that LROC has, that they can match these images because of the clarity, the focus, the film, something about the grain of the film just picked up everything that's on the ground there. And that's about what I've got here, you know, for Aristarchus right now at the moment. If you look like at the northern part of it here, you see all the terracing that's falling there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, within this terracing, in the fine scale images, there are girders. They all radiate from a central point, and along the edge of this crater, well, crater dome, whatever it is, there are places where the edge has not slumped, where you can see there are stubs, like maybe there were large supports that were embedded in the edge. Look along the edge of the crater, and you'll see. I can see one of them. It's sort of like at the 8 o'clock position along the bottom. There's a large, like a stub. And these things are spaced sort of regularly around the crater where the edge is preserved. And they could have been
like supports. They were huge supports for the dome.
Right. And if you look within, you'll...
In probably tension.
Yeah.
And things get stronger in tension.
Well, when you look along the edge, though, if you see the one that's at the 8 o'clock position, if you look within the crater from it in the radial position, like from the center of the crater, you will see there's large structures that are laying in line there that could very well be the beams of this with the pieces of glass or spinel or whatever. You know, did you hear about that, Richard, how they've developed transparent metals?
Yes, yes.
Okay, well, perhaps that's what they made this out of.
Or something even more sophisticated. But again, if our technology can begin to hint at how you might do this, give us 1,000 years and we'll be doing this all over. And, of course, that's probably what we did in the very distant past.
Exactly. But this kind of thing, you know, if you wouldn't think to look into a crater to look for a kind of thing like this. But this crater is special. You can see from the Clementine images, you can see, you know, especially in comparison to, you know, ones that were taken of other craters. This one is special because it is so different from the outside.
Well, it's the brightest, most reflective feature on the moon. It's been noted by everybody looking just at the moon with a casual eye. That's why I wanted Rich and Keith to get the image up, and I really thank them for getting a full moon image. And we've got about 6 minutes left in this segment. Guys, let's kind of stand back and have big picture conversation. What does this all mean? From each of your perspectives, what now do you think this all means?
Everybody speak at once.
Well, Keith, go first.
Okay.
Well, what it means to me is that there's been some kind of decision to go ahead and show us what's there. and not announce it with any fanfare. Just slip it out there and let those that notice see. You know, let he who hath eyes, let him see.
And to build up the public database, so when this does hit the fan, they can say, "Oh, look, we showed it to you all along."
Well, you know something? They didn't show us these panoramic photos like this all along, because look how hard it would have been to display these humongous images with the technology that they had then.
That's a very good point. Except if, like I did when I started my research, I went and I ordered negatives from NSSDC, the National Space Science Data Center there at Goddard, and I would take them to private labs, and I would have labs like in Houston blow them up huge, and I'd have my friend Kerry in New York, you know, at a private photographic company, make big sectional blow-ups. My mutual, you know, friend Steve Troy has been doing this with the moon for decades. So there would have been a way to do this, but you couldn't have democratized the results the way we can now.
Right. Now, anybody can go to this site, go to the sites where these pictures are and click and look, download them, work with them, you know, that sort of thing. Oh, my gosh, you know what we're going to do, Richard? We're going to miss Hadley Mountain, and that was the next thing down.
Let's go to Hadley.
It is totally anomalous.
We have time.
Go back to my page, and right below that great big Aristarchus image, which was number 7, there's another picture, and this is Hadley Mountain.
Let's give people a perspective. What is Hadley? Where was it, and who photographed it?
Apollo 15 landed right near Hadley Mountain. They went somewhat close to it. They took really detailed 500 millimeter lens pictures.
Okay, just to be sure, the Hadley Mountain we're now discussing is nowhere near Aristarchus. It's more like at the 11 o'clock position if you look at the full moon, and you go down kind of inside the limb. In other words, it's in the northern hemisphere of the moon. It's in the upper right-hand corner, as you see it, and it's nowhere near Aristarchus, but it's on the edge of what's called Mare Imbrium. It's part of those mountains that ring what's called Mare Imbrium, the dark area on the upper left-hand side of the moon.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you really want to see it, if you go back to Radio with Pictures, and you look down, I think that Rich has added, Keith has added us a link to it. There's a picture that NASA, number 16 on Radio with Pictures. This says Mount Hadley 500 Comp DMH. This is a NASA, that's a NASA composite image of Mount Hadley off in the distance.
Okay, Skype dropout.
See all the striations on it. The same thing. Okay, what we're looking at on Mount Hadley, the striations, the lines, the actual ruins that are there are the same things that are on the mountains that we see in Aristarchus and other areas. And we think that they're arcologies, just like at the Apollo 17 site, South Massive. It's the same way, has the same kind of striations, big, large dome.
Skype again.
They're derelict for a long time, ever since, like you say, ever since the war.
Look at this.
It's just amazing, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
All right, well, if you click off of that, I have some 500 millimeter photos fresh from the first generation negatives.
Okay, hang on. This was a shot looking north from the landed Apollo 15 vehicle. And what they did, for the only time in the entire Apollo program, Keith, they had the astronaut, in this case, Scott, I forget his last name, he did what was called a stand-up EVA, where they opened the top hatch and they stood up in their spacesuits, and he took the 500 millimeter lens camera and he photographed the hell out of the entire landscape of 360 panorama, and these images are part of that stand-up EVA.
Well, I'm telling you what, it's a good thing I was an astronaut here, because I would have went off EVA, because I'd have to go to it. I'd have to see this up close, no doubt about it. But they did the next best thing, and they took 500 millimeter photographs of the surface of it. And I mean, these things, you can see a gnat on them. And if you go back to...
Look at all that cubicle 3D geometry.
Mm-hmm.
In heavy erosion. I mean, again, you got to have an eye, folks. You got to understand what artificial things look like when you beat the hell out of them.
Oh, it's closer than that. If you go back to Radio with Pictures to link number 15, which is my Aristarchus page, and scroll down to the very bottom, there is the 500 millimeter up close image. This is this is a frame from one of that series of the composite image that we saw above. Okay. They have released the individual frames. If you click on that image, you can see the striations on it immediately. If you click on it, it brings up a large image that, it lays it all bare for you. There's your eroding decks. There's your structure. This entire mountain is an arcology. You can sit and pick for hours. And I want you people, too, I put these images out here for this purpose. Pick through there, man. Find what you want. Post them. Show us what you see. Because I cannot find everything in this, man. It's so much. And there are round objects that look like gears. There are craft laying here. There are decks laying here. There are pipes sticking out. There are girders. There is no limit to what's here. It's all the trappings of a super high technological civilization laid on the side of this mountain.
Do you remember the ancient Sumerian term for what we're seeing?
A house like mountain built.
The Ikur, house like a mountain built. Okay, sorry, Darren. Darren's calling in. We don't have time because I've got 2 minutes left, and I want to hear from Andrew and Bob and Will as to big picture. Where do we go from here?
Well, Richard, one thing I was mentioning talking with Em about was there seems to be a real growing sense of urgency here, not just because we had a lot of material tonight, but there is a feeling like something is pushing to the edge. It's a gut feeling, and I felt it tangibly tonight.
Wow.
And I think there's more to come.
Okay. Andrew?
That was me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Will.
As we dig into these photos, I think we're going to find more and more, especially with these lunar photos. And like you said, it's 3 days away. And with the propulsion systems we've got coming out now, we could maybe even get it a little bit faster. So that's actually in our reach. So wonderful, wonderful.
Wonderful.
So I think we're moving towards that age where they're going to let – I think you're right about the fact that they're giving themselves an out. Hey, we have it out there for you, but it's there.
See, my time frame for all this hitting the you-know-what is the end of the year. Same time as the election where it's all going to hit the you-know-what. It's all hitting it together because the physics is peaking and the good are getting better and the inside information held for decades is finally coming out. Bob, final thoughts? Bob? Hello, Bob.
Unmuted now. Just get the feeling you're going to wake up one day, turn on the internet, look at the news, and see a story giving confirmation of all we've been talking about over the years. So that's my feeling about what's going on.
Excellent way to end the program this morning. Guys, we're out of time. This has been another episode in the continuing odyssey and adventures of the Imaging 4. To be added to from time to time. Hey, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in and staying with us. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same station, just keep remembering, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.